Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by our friends at Edwards and Sons of Surrey, Virginia. www.surreyfarms.com.
Hi, we're here. We're back at the Q Report. This is Mark Marabella.
Patrick Martins,
co-host.
And I'm Ed Grant, other co-host.
And we also have in the studio today Chris
Sherman.
Chris Sherman. Chris, what's your specialty?
Well, I live in Florida, so my specialty could be Cuban sandwiches.
Excellent.
But he knows every unusual food tradition, regional food tradition, especially in Cincinnati.
Well, considering today, today's theme of the Q Report is, as we always have a theme, is fear. Mm-hmm. Considering the last week. Actually, it should probably be more like... We have one of those or no?
No, we have this.
That's the avian part.
Yeah. Right. So as I'm sure everybody who's unfortunately listened or tried to avoid the media this week has heard about swine flu, quotes, pandemic, which we have something to talk about.
We have a few things to talk about. Let's start off with one. I don't know if you know this, Mark. What is the definition of pandemic? I mean, what makes it a pandemic, not an epidemic?
Please tell me.
It's number of countries it reaches. It has nothing to do with death rate or numbers of people infected. It's just its geographical reach.
How many countries do you have to reach to be qualified as a pandemic?
I think it has to transverse at least one continent, jump a continent. But it might be all of them, but it is showing up everywhere now. But it has nothing to do with death rate.
Right.
Sort of like a risk game.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost arbitrary, you know?
I don't really understand what the fear is exactly, considering that, influenza, the current influenza virus, I mean, I realize this is a different strain and we're going to talk about that, but, so far to this year, what are we in now, May? 16,000 have died in this country already from the normal, worldwide, we've had what, 200?
As Mayor Bloomberg whined his way through, which I love him, I mean, I was like, I'm angry, was... Every year, tens of thousands of people get the flu in New York, and unfortunately, hundreds to thousands die every year. And it's just like, it's the flu.
Yeah. Let me start off, Ed. That was very good about your definition. Hopefully, information will stick out there, we hope. But since my bent is also science, as I do science, principally science documentaries, let me just start out with little facts that are actually supportable. The current swine flu virus, if everybody, which we'll get into, but I very much think it has to do, who is attached to it more than the actual.
Oh, we'll
fear.
Get into our.
But it in fact started this particular strain actually started or the predominance of it principally started in North Carolina hog farming, which is really the belt of. Industrial hog farming. I mean, just listen to the statistic. And of course, these are very simple things. Anything, a virus needs population in which to mutate and breed fast, right? So the more opportunity to breed, the better chances of something transferring from humans and animals and back again, because it has more opportunity to mutate. So as this, I'm going to quote a CDC.
Center for Disease Control.
Thank you, Patrick. And this is written by Dr. Michael Greger. This just came out in just a few days ago. He says, it's likely no coincidence that the virus emerged in North Carolina. This is, by the way, just to be specific, we knew it emerged from a factory in Mexico, but the principal, three-quarters of the principal virus was initiated in North Carolina in 1998.
And the factory farm in Mexico... actually is owned by an American producer.
Of course. The home of the nation's largest pig production in North Carolina has the densest pig population in North America, reportedly boasts more than twice as many corporate pig mega factories as any other state. But here's the significant thing, as if that's not big enough. In 98 was the year North Carolina's pig population hit 10 million, up from 2 million just 6 years earlier. Ironically, at the same time that had happened, for some reason we concentrated a lot of pig farming in North Carolina because actually factory farms had gone down at the same time. So there was almost five times fewer farms. But by crowding about 25 times more pigs into each operation. So that is
density. It's a density.
And it spread across the country because the pigs are raised in North Carolina. fattened up in Iowa and then butchered in, or many of them butchered in California for transportation reasons and transportation costs. So,
and there are fewer farms with those is the thing. I mean, the number of farms went from 15,000 in 1986 to 3,600 14 years later. So, I mean, that's talk about density. It's a double-edged.
And they're working. And
it's sort of the daycare center phenomenon. I mean, the pigs are brought together, and pigs are uniquely susceptible to viruses. And
right, but you know, not any more so than the human being.
Mark, no, they're very much like human beings.
Yeah, Mark and I were talking about that. They use pigs to test, human medicines.
Right. And, no, right. I'm not saying it's a problem. I'm saying that's just basically a feature of pigs.
But okay, one thing I want to bring up before we really lose it. Okay, one, we all agree that industrialized farming concentrates populations, allows for mutation.
We don't have to agree, it's a fact. Yeah. And you don't have to agree or not,
and
it's just a fact.
Globalized transportation systems, you know, just like the flu epidemic of 1918, because we were in a war, everybody was everywhere, it spread faster. But there are
It was 50 million versus 200, which doesn't even show up.
But stay with the fear concept.
Yeah.
I heard on NPR an unchallenged interview, which just it sent my brain just boiling, was somebody was interviewed and they're like, well, I'm not going to eat pork because I'm going to be extra cautious. It's not being extra cautious. It's being extra stupid. Okay. Eating the pork had nothing to do with getting flu.
Well,
And I think because there's so much misinformation out there, to let that comment hang.
Right.
And not be commented on was irresponsible.
Well, likewise with the Egyptians killing their swine population.
Yes.
Well, that was a religious thing, I think. They used perfect convenience to.
Yeah, you might think, but, ignorance probably beyond.
Well, look today, at Russia.
Today there were violent clashes between pig farmers, Christian pig farmers, so that answers that question, and the police. Hmm. And so you can have this sort of misinformation and fear lead to societies having potential breakdowns.
And leading into our next guest eventually, in a couple minutes, if we're talking about fear, of course, I think this has everything to do with where it currently emanates, which is fear of the other. We have quotes, the immigration quotes problem in this country, quotes,
the xenophobia issue. Yeah, Michelle Bachmann from Minnesota, idiot. saying this is the Democrats' conspiracy to Mexicans are running us over. I mean, it's disgusting
ridiculous.
This happens.
Well, I made a list just from one day of the New York Times letters. It's not just the Mexicans. It's anybody who eats meat. It's the Bush administration.
Oh, of course.
And it's just, swine flu. You get the swine flu you want. It reflects whatever your enemies are.
Oh, yes. Conspiracy theories are not the sole providence of the right wing.
Although
there's plenty of
left-wing
nuts out
there. Well, yeah, left-wing.
Except
they're
usually right. That's the difference.
Accusing some of these industrial hog farms, it is kind of like the plague in the medieval times. No one knew what it was, but everyone had an idea.
Right.
It ended up being the rats.
Actually the lice.
The fleas.
Well, it's the English disease, the French disease.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's true.
Well, this has been very, very, very interesting, and we'll continue this theme, with our next guest. What is our next guest's name?
David Seelig is a PhD candidate. I think he's a PhD already. He's a post-grad at University of Pennsylvania. He's going to talk about the research of the brain. How does fear work, and why do people sort of panic?
After that, we're going to have an artist who has a certain fear component to some of his paintings.
His paintings, they're a little frightening.
It's a little bit of a stretch, but we're
No. There's a feeling of something's unwell in his paintings.
And then talk about industrial agriculture, which does have a lot of fear. We're going to talk about a kind of reaction to fear. with urban farming.
Yeah.
Then there's actually a surprise guest who I didn't tell you guys about, but she is an actress in a play about plastic surgery, and I know there's a lot of fear there, and I saw the play last night. She was great in it, so she's going to come way at the very tippity-top
end. We met her, actually. She's great. She was worried that she was late, but she's actually going to be there for an hour now, so.
Okay, yeah, she's not anywhere close. I fear she's going to leave. Anyway, we will be back after this short station break.
Great. You know his glass is full of sand, and it feels just like a jaybird, the way it fits into his hand. He rolled a blade up in his trick towel. They slapped their hands against the wall. You never trip, you never stumble. He's walking Spanish down the hall. Slip him a picture of our Jesus, or give him a spoon to dig a hole. Well, all it done ain't no one's business, but any blankets for the cold. They dim the lights over on Broadway. Even the king is bowed his head. Never face looks right up at Mason. He's walking Spanish down the hall. The teller's screeching for a blind pig. Punk Sanders carved it out of wood. He never sang when he got hoodwinked. They tried it all, but he never would. Tomorrow morning there'll be laundry, but he'll be somewhere else to hear the call. Okay, we're back at the Q Report. I'm Mark Marabella with Patrick Martins, Ed Grant, and sitting in today is with Chris Thurman from Florida. Happy to have you here, Chris. We're going to bring a guest on now. Today's theme of the Q Report is fear. Everything's scary and some things not. We have David Selig coming in on the phone from University of Pennsylvania. David, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
David, for our listeners out there, tell us a little bit about your work and what you're doing in University of Pennsylvania.
Okay, yeah. So I'm a combined degree student in veterinary medicine and also working on a PhD in neuroscience with Daniel Langlaven and Dr. Ruben Gurr. Dr. Langlaven has been working in the last 8 years or so with deception. And we've been looking at the brain responses when someone is deceiving while inside a functional magnetic resonance imaging. I also am interested in studying social dynamics and primate behavior.
You're like right on the bullseye for what we're talking about today, which is a fear of specifically the swine flu. You could probably come at it in
primate behavior.
Primate behavior and veterinary medicine both. So, David, tell us a little bit about what happens. I know Dr. Langlaben, who I developed this a series with, has done a lot of is known as fMRI. People have had MRIs. It's similar, essentially watching the brain light up as it's functioning, and seeing which parts of the brain are responsible for what functions. When you're thinking about or feeling a certain thing, tell us what you guys have found out or what you've done in the field of fear.
Well, we haven't studied fear in particular, at least not yet. Though it certainly is related to deception, because often people are afraid while they're lying because they are afraid they may get caught.
Right.
But I think I generally take a very kind of evolutionary approach to these sorts of questions. And I think that I actually would cut off for a moment, so I wasn't sure if you covered this yet, but the fact that people tend to have almost a mass hysteria when a new disease, of the day or of the year comes out and people get all freaked out about it. And I think that it can pretty much be tied to two separate processes. First is fear versus actual pain or suffering. Generally, fear has evolved as a response to avoid to avoid a potentially negative or lethal stimulus, And that actually causes us to really focus on these things and even maybe put them out of proportion to avoid them. Often, this has actually become topical, like in the debate on torture. People actually tend to respond more towards fear than to actual pain, because pain actually will create a coping response and tends to actually nullify the actual stimulus much more so than like fear would.
So you're talking more about, say, the animal fear, like from our hippocampus type fear, like you know flight or fight. You know, actually, I'm about to be mauled by a bear, I'm afraid. Versus
that's right. So you know, when you hear about this new disease and it's scary and you don't know what it is, you're more likely to, before you even know what it is, you're more likely to be scared of it, because that's a response that's pretty much evolved to protect us.
David, let me just ask you quickly. This is very interesting to me, because Ed and I were talking about this prior to the show. We had a friend who had a sort of a scary diagnosis, and as it turned out, it was fine. But in the sense of having, fear is often not ameliorated in any way by any sort of rational information. So if it starts off with ignorance, it doesn't seem like people are responsive necessarily. The fact that, the swine flu is very, frankly, non-lethal in the sense of statistically speaking, not that it can't kill people, but it's the people who are usually at risk, which are small children who's died, and people who are already ill. The same people who die of flu are generally more at risk for most diseases. So why doesn't information necessarily help stem the sort of, fear and ignorance as it kind of spreads?
Well, when people look at topics like self-deception, they typically look at how we might irrationally avoid something that's unpleasant and not think about it. Kind of the prototypical example is when a spouse thinks that their spouse is cheating on them, they may actually avoid learning anything about it because they want to feel comfortable in their marriage. However, what's just as likely, as really much epitomized by Shakespeare's Othello, is that someone will actually become hypervigilant when they think something negative is happening. And this has been called twisted self-deception, but it's actually, I think, probably just the commonest self-deception, where, and it's also seen in hypochondriacs, where you will actually, when you suspect something, you become so worried about it that that's all you can think about, and you end up proving what actually doesn't even exist. In Othello's case, he proved that he proved to himself that his wife was cheating on him when she was not. And in the case of hypochondria or mass hysteria, you end up convincing yourself that something really bad's out there when it may not be as bad as you think it is.
I'm happy you mentioned that, because Mark and Ed have been trying to oust me from co-hosting the Q Report, and I think that's obnoxious. And I'm happy that you helped reveal them. Jeez.
Yeah, we're very Shakespearean in our motivations here in the room.
I was reminded of the L train. I love that the L train tells you how long your pain is. 28 minutes.
That really matters.
It's fine. I'd rather know it's 28 minutes. I can cope with it rather than...
I want to lean over and look down the tunnel for the next half hour.
Even if it's 30 seconds away, I just want to know.
I can relax and enjoy my book then.
But, yes. But also, from your work with group, the idea of groupthink and morality and how it actually is being played out in the brain, not necessarily under our control. In the Times today, there's a chart about other pandemics and the scapegoat factor. And, of course, now there are certain aspects of our political system trying to scapegoat Mexicans,
right,
for this. Is there something, the reaction is, or the xenophobic reaction, the blame the other, how's that work, with how our brains actually work?
Well, okay, let's see, that's kind of complicated, because it actually ties into several different evolutionary, probably evolved tendencies. One of the things that I think is directly related to what you're talking about is the contrast between new and old. And this actually very much ties into the work we've done so far in identifying when someone is deceiving. Often, we tend to habituate to stimuli or things in our environment, even if they're really horrible things, like the fact that when you're driving a car, there's a pretty decent risk every time you get behind the wheel you're going to get into an accident, far more so than dying of swine flu. And however, we tend to acclimate to these sorts of things. But when something is new and novel, we've evolved these very robust responses to really attend to this information and really it's so well characterizable in the brain, activating such generally the prefrontal cortex and the parietal cortex that you can actually identify when someone is lying, even if they are a total sociopath and they're not even at all stressed out about lying. But the very fact that a lie often involves, it's often a novel behavior, or even in sometimes only a lie involves like you can give someone a task where where only the liar would recognize a new stimulus. It's called a guilty knowledge test.
Great, David. We're going to come back again. We got to take a break, and we'll come back on that notion of lying.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Hi, we're back at the Q Report. This is Mark Marbella, co-host with Patrick Martins.
Hello.
And Ed Grant.
Hey, how's it going?
And Chris Thurman has gone away back to the delicious bar here at Roberta's.
He's gone to and then he's off to the world of Scrapple and Tampa Bay, where he studies every unusual food tradition that exists.
Fantastic.
There.
And we have with us Paul Vogel in the studio, who will be joining us, listening in for this segment and joining us next. He's an artist.
Hello.
But we're bringing back... Paul, you still there? Paul Selig. Paul, we wanted to pick up on the novelty.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm sorry. Are you on?
Yeah.
Can you hear us?
Yeah.
We wanted to pick up on the novelty factor. We thought that was very interesting. And Patrick had an interesting question too. Go ahead, Patrick. Off when we were off
can
mic.
It work in reverse? Could you actually be in severe danger, but some part of your brain persuades you to think that you're really not in danger?
Yes, certainly. I mean, all these processes have their maladaptive counterparts, and that actually kind of ties into the other aspect of xenophobia, which is really an irrational response. It's generally an irrational fear, so people tend to fear the unknown and attribute negative qualities to it as a result to it, when the unknown may actually be positive or should not be feared. I think that there's a component we have the tendency to I think I headed myself. Could you please re-ask your question?
Sure. The idea of, Patrick asked the idea of, can it work in reverse? Meaning, you know, that can you be in actual danger, but your brain convinces itself or your person that you're not, in fact, in danger? Meaning, risky behavior essentially is the
maladaptive,
another way.
Maladaptive.
Maladaptive is the opposite of convincing yourself that something bad's going to happen.
Well, yes. I mean, people actually differ in a lot of these. You know, there's a lot of variation between different people in terms of how responsive they are to novelty, as well as safe. You know, as well as old cues. Some people actually. There is some sort of equilibrium that people try to reach, and so the people that tend to not be very responsive to novel cues might actually tend to expose themselves in situations that sort of rev up the system more, and they might actually engage in these very dangerous behaviors.
Yeah, I think this is Ed. You know, I despise people. I really don't like people. I don't like crowds, but I love living in New York. I love living in Brooklyn. You know,
it helps prepare you for novelty. That's for sure.
Yeah. No, I mean, I grew up in a very small place, but I did find an equilibrium that is very comfortable to me.
Right.
That I can't replicate anywhere else.
You're a resident misanthrope, right?
With you.
Yes, with me. Absolutely.
Ed grew up here.
Ed grew up in Vermont,
and now he lives here.
David, I just wanted to pick up on one more point. We have about a minute left. Is that right? Lost in all this, of course, we can get really, it can get very complex. And of course, the brain, you guys are just, you know, you should make a point. We should make a point to say you're just really starting to tap and kind of watch it work, so to speak, as it lights up. But, where does personality play in all this? People have, as they come into these studies, have a proclivity, right? I mean, in the sense of we're talking about somebody who, we all have people in our lives who are automatically will react in a fearful way, and then people who sort of have more of a tolerance for what others would think of as risk, right? There's some people who jump off buildings and think that's fine and survive, obviously, all the time, and usually mostly, actually. I mean, base jumpers, not suicide numbers.
Yes.
Anyway, do you guys, when you screen, I mean, like, you know, the point is like, how general to the population are these studies, or is it more specific to, because obviously you guys have to sort of weed out, which is pretty interesting to me, what is obviously gray area. You need to come down into more black and white factors. So of these, of fear, in specifically speaking of fear, how can you define that in such a way as to the general population?
Well, I mean, the general population generally has a normal variation in really all of these features. But what we often give personality tests, and actually even much more recently, there's been an effort to do genetic screening. For example, the dopamine system is very tied into to our ability to experience reward, and some people tend to have a hyperactive reward system that's actually correlated with genetic markers for dopamine. You can take a population and examine whether they have one particular genetic variant or the other for dopamine release, and then you can look to see whether the people that have a hyperactive dopamine system tend to be more likely to be thrill seeking or tend to have different behavioral responses to various tasks.
Interesting. So give us the two extreme examples. What would the dopamine look like for somebody who's jumping off a base, off of the top of a building, versus someone who doesn't even want to look up when the guy's jumping?
Well, so someone who probably is more of a thrill seeker probably has a lower baseline endogenous dopamine release.
It takes a lot to fire it, essentially.
It takes a lot to fire it, so they sometimes go overboard. Actually, one thing that's kind of interesting is...
David, we have about 20 seconds, just to let you know.
Maybe I won't go into that. But, okay. But you can also find personality variants, like sociopaths, tend to have damage to this dopamine system, for example.
Damage means what? That it doesn't fire? So you need...
They actually have less activity... And so they tend to experience reward much more weakly than maybe a normal person. And that correlates not only their own thrill-seeking behavior, but also sometimes in what they allow themselves to do to others.
Interesting. Well, David, I wish we could talk longer, and hopefully we'll have you back on if you're willing.
Yeah, very, very well.
The next time there's a media-generated scare of something novel.
I think we can pretty much predict that will happen. So yeah. I think we could have David back again.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, David. Man.
Radio Network. This is the Q Report, and
it certainly is.
I'm Ed, and I'm here with Mark.
Hello.
I'm Patrick.
Nice, Patrick.
Q stands for quotidian.
Definition?
Everyday.
Everyday culture.
Everyday culture.
The mundane.
Okay, and we're happy to welcome Paul Vogler.
Hello.
Paul is a painter.
I am.
And he just celebrated the finishing of his BFA. How are you feeling, Paul?
I did. And I told you, Ed, where I'm going to hang that BFA diploma.
Yes.
I'm going to get a nice gold frame. I'm going to stick it right above my toilet.
Excellent. Excellent. It's worth more than than maybe toilet paper.
I think it's someplace where you...
I just want to have... I need a place to put all those degrees.
You'll see it every day.
Yeah.
So
we're here based on where we come from. We're talking about fear today.
Yes, and the unknown.
Our novel.
Brain. Yes, our brain scientists talked about novelty, and I don't think there's anything better or anyone better to talk about novelty and the unknown than a painter. Every time you start a new painting, you're in front of a blank canvas.
That's right. It's completely blank, and you sort of gotta go in there and sort of, you know, sort of begin a dialogue with that canvas, and in that dialogue becomes the act of creation. So
I've heard there's two types of painters. One is someone who comes in with an idea and tries to carry it out, and the other one is more like Jackson Pollock, you know, gets taken by the canvas. And the,
yeah, that's that whole sort of romantic thing that happened in the 50s and 60s and like sort of post-war America. And all these guys are like these introverts, painters down in, you know, Lower East Side paying $10 a month rent, and they were getting their canvas and sort of throwing paint on it and, you know, expressing their existential, like, angst. And, you know, that's a great time. Like, you know, a lot of white males, like, running stuff, you know, doing their paintings. And but now it's, like, you know, it's sort of changed a bit. And a lot of people sort of kind of come in, especially, you know, I kind of come in with sort of a preconceived idea of what I want to create. Like, I have a sketch or something like in mind. And it's sort of, it's about taking that sketch and bringing it to a final product.
Tell us a little bit about your work and your process to get there.
A lot of my recent work is dealing sort of with the ABEX guys were doing in the 50s and 60s was dealing with the existential angst and themes of death and resurrection. However, they were doing with sort of a color-filled painting, and they were trying to get into the psychology of color. I'm doing it a little more, trying to base it more in iconography as well as the way you use the paint. A lot of the more recent work involves sort of expressing sort of dreams I've had as well as different existential ideas I have. So a lot of the iconography is sort of dark, darker palettes, birch forests, First World War soldiers, sort of birds, ibises, sparrows sort of fluttering around. And I've actually started to put myself within the paintings to sort of express all this thing, sort of try to react to the world around me and express it.
Yeah, there is definitely a feeling of menace, you know, in your current paintings.
I mean,
yeah.
The world's a scary place.
Yeah, it's really, at the same time, also, we should say that it's paulvogler.com, right?
Paulvogler.com.
Paul Vogler. We can. It's V O G E L E R.
Correct.
And but looking at, I was struck by, I very much respond to birch forests. I'm a northern boy, Buffalo, Canada. I always think of those as being, I mean, for me, again, people, most people I run into anyway, hate snow. Like, I love that. To me, that isolation and desolation, those are my, you know, that's, I often, if they're not around, I often seek them. Mm-hmm. But in your painting specifically, they're clearly dark, and it's clearly a sort of a winter feel, a northern feel. But then there's these beautiful, very colorful birds, which you can look at both ways. At the same time, you know, on one hand, it's certainly very hopeful and colorful compared to its palette that it's surrounding that around. At the same time, it's sort of sad that there's this thing kind of sitting in the middle of this sort of vacant place.
Yeah, and what really sort of inspired the birds was a lot of research into sort of First World War, and especially books like Under Fire, Storm of Steel, and All Quiet on the Western Front. There's passages where they're talking about getting shelled to bits, except, you know, the birds are still fluttering around in the trees. So here, sort of man is destroying himself, and, you know, continually sort of do that, yet sort of nature and birch forests and birds will still sort of exist, and the world will sort of right itself.
Interesting, yeah. And as we're talking about the original flu pandemic, which World War One very much created, because of course here are these guys in these horrible situations, all packed together, in from various countries, which, you know, is among the first time that it had happened. And so there was all this disease and pestilence, and as is often the case, disease mm-hmm. took way more than shells or bullets did.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there was the 1918 flu pandemic, actually, right. Which wiped out 100 million people.
Yeah,
so, right.
More than the actual war. Right. Know, yeah. Wars happened. Right.
What was the name, talking about birds, of the Kentucky Derby winner? What was it?
I don't.
I'm bird in a mine or something.
Yeah,
like that.
It had the word bird in it. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
And birds are hidden. And just for baseball, Bird Fidrich just passed away, which I was very sad about. Oh. That Mark the Bird from the Detroit pitcher. Yeah. The last time that the Tigers won the World Series.
But thank God, Larry Bird's Celtics passed on through the second round, beating the Bulls. But anyway, it was a huge upset, by the way. Well, we're going to take a brief break, and we're going to come back and talk more about fearfulness and art.
Falling James in the Tahoma. Stick around and tell us all the tale. When I fell in love with a Gun Street girl. And I was dancing in the Birmingham jail. Dancing in the Birmingham jail. I took $100 off a Slaughterhouse Joe. Bought a brand new Michigan 20 gauge. You got all liquored up on that roadhouse corn. Mexico. With a pawn shop radio, 4:15. Left Walt Keegan at the slamming of the door. Left Walt Keegan at the slamming of the door. I said, John, John, he's long gone. Gone to Indiana, he never come home. I said, John.
Hey, we're back with The Cue with Patrick, Mark, and our guest, Paul.
Hi. Hey, Paul. Hey, everybody.
So, Paul, you know, we've been talking about fear, the unknown. We've talked about, you know, you're in the studio, you have a blank canvas. What possessed you to leave a perfectly fine career in architecture to become a painter?
Architects, you know.
Uh-huh.
We only have 6 minutes, right? So
yeah.
Better keep it short. Well, you know, I like to start this little bit off with a quote from Gordon Matta-Clark, who, you know, most everybody knows was involved with architecture, specifically dissecting, you know, architectural
yes.
structures.
And, yeah, and if they didn't, I mean, he did these amazing pieces in the 70s where right. he would cut buildings into quarters, right, in big, huge holes out of them. And they only exist now in photographs. They don't exist any other way than in photographs.
They're very ephemeral, and that was the whole thing. Yeah. And I think there's a quote by him that really struck hard to me, was that he quotes, architects are the lackey of the wealthy. And I didn't want to be that lackey anymore. But maybe artists are as well. But, you know, I studied architecture for a very long time. I worked in one of the most prestigious firms in the world, KPF, on 57th Street. You know, they employ, I don't know, 500 people, 1,000 people worldwide. They build everything. And really, I think the problem with architecture is that there is no art in it. You're basically sort of helping rich get richer, and you're sort of developing these buildings that are pretty pretty detrimental to the environment. And I just couldn't combine my lifestyle with that, align it, and I felt like everything that I was doing was sort of hurting the world. And
so you didn't feel like the master creator, the Atlas shrugging fountain head.
I often, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I'm like George Costanza. I really always wanted to be an architect. Vandelay Industries. But I often thought that too. It's sort of like, you know, I think of all the arts, and they're all horribly frustrating and at times, you know, horribly depressing. But meaning to trying to sort of struggle through it, you know, no matter what you're doing. But it seems to me architecture specifically, because if you walk down the street, it's like it's most frustrating, because you're really putting the ephemeral into the physical.
Exactly.
And what do we walk by every day, right? Cinder block. I mean, we all see, you know, you're talking about space and materials. There's so much involved.
Well, you're also
involved.
An architect might argue that you're talking about the difference between building
and architecture. You know, most architects like to think that they're artists.
Yes, I know. They think they're the best artists.
And they like to go out and they're like, look at my buildings, look at my paintings, look at my furniture. And but the truth is that, you know, they're engineers, and that 98% of architecture out there isn't architecture, it's building.
Yeah, but I would call them space designers. I mean, in such a way. I mean, they're figuring out how to kind of enclose interior space in such a way.
But that's the thing. Most of them don't think about it, because it is a grid that gets cinder blocked.
Right.
The water column is here. The kitchen's here.
Right. Which ultimately, you know, you have to do. My cousins are architects as well. So I mean,
sorry, it's didn't mean to diss the family.
No. It's a very frustrating. It seems to me very. I mean, yeah.
Well, you know, I just have to say, I want to make something clear. Even though I don't paint anymore, I was educated as a painter.
Yeah.
And I do
and
have the bias.
Your work is still painterly. Yeah, I would say.
But I do have the bias that painting is the high art.
Painting is the highest art.
Architects are just full of themselves, and they're wrong, you know.
Can painting still be high art even if it's like primitive painting, like some of those Brazilian South American ones? Is that still
considered high art? We don't want to get into the argument of intentionality and the act of creation, but yes, painting is definitely where it stands.
So from where I'm coming from as a filmmaker, I always think of filmmaking, you know, as images, moving images being
sorry,
sort of
dude,
the next.
It's not painting.
It's not. It's opera. It's just
you can
opera.
Spin it however
on,
you want.
You know, digital or whatever. So.
I mean, working with light. We have Wolfgang in the audience today in the studio, who is a director of photography. So, you know, they're often painting, you know, if he's got his, even if he doesn't have a budget, often with what available light he has. Is it similar? I mean, because paintings are really, I mean, if you talk about as an architecture in an abstract way, you know, closing space, are you really working with light? I mean, especially your paintings, I would say,
Paul. Yeah, I mean,
Paul.
I think with painting, you're working with everything. You're working with form, you're working with space, you're working with color, you're working with light. You're working with philosophy, religion, everything in the history of the whole world. But then you sort of translate it into one restricted medium of this gelatinous pigment onto a canvas. And that is the most sort of traditional sort of painting. I'm not to put down any other sort of multimedia form, but a lot of people go to other multimedia forms because they can't paint. And that's fine. But there's something about sort of mastering the technique of moving this sort of dispersed, ground cobalt that's got a little bit of copper in it in some sort of oil with a brush made of horsehair on some linen. That's very difficult.
It's very physical.
Sort of translate all the things in the whole humanity to the point of revelation onto a canvas, I think, is one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah, that's a very interesting. Let me just one second, Ed. But that's a very interesting point you bring up, because when you're standing in front of any painting, you're physically in front of the artist's as opposed to the work that I've done will be broadcast and copied. Like there's no physical tangibility to that. Whereas, I can actually see, and if I shouldn't touch your the oil in your canvas, it's like I can physically see the act.
I mean, painting's been around for 30,000 years, and the painting, it stays outside the ebb and flow of technology. I think it's, if you sort of align your work with technology, it's going to be dated very, very, very soon.
And we should talk about food art one day, next time you come on, because there's a certain ephemeral thing. It's right there. It is an art piece, and you eat it.
Yeah, it's very much, I mean, and you're very much part of the tradition of the people who created that same recipe. I mean, it's, you're very much acting.
So, and people not only see it, but they touch it and then eat it and swallow it.
Well, as an undergraduate, a big thing when we went to museums was after the visit, we'd all like compare who touched what. So,
how many impressionists did you ruin?
Well, no, but none of us touched Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon because we just figured a cage would fall out of the roof of the MoMA and like trap us. But I want to thank Paul for coming in and talking about art. And, you know, and the unknown, the new, the creative, like Proust said, you know, good artists remake the universe every time they make a new piece. So, Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Report at Roberta's restaurant.
We certainly are.
I am with Mark and
my name's Ed.
Ed Grant. And we have a very exciting guest. So far, the theme of this show has been fear. And we started off talking about H1N1, mm-hmm. you know, formerly known as the swine flu.
Fear and lack thereof, really.
And that's fear, but there's a kind of reaction to fear, a positive reaction, which is the urban farming movement. And we have a special guest, Anastasia Plakius.
Hi.
Welcome, Anastasia.
Thanks.
Where are you coming from today?
I'm coming from Greenpoint, where there was a massive bike ride, so it took us over an hour to get in.
But oh, you were trapped on the wrong side of the five boroughs?
Yeah. This is, you know, it's, I'm always on the bike. Now we're in the car. So for the first time, it was actually, you know, faster to get.
For those who don't know, the Greenpoint is like right next to us. So I mean, the idea that it took an hour.
But the five borough bike tour, man, if you are on the wrong side of that, in a car especially, it takes a little creativity.
It was rough.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Anastasia, I've known you for years, but most recently and most excitingly, we are kind of involved a little bit in a garden on the roof. For people who don't know, the shipping container, the Heritage Radio Network's in a shipping container, and on the roof is a real active garden. Then there's also another garden down the block. Tell us a little bit about some of this gardening work that you're up to.
Yeah, we were lucky enough. We had some really kind and generous folks down the block who offered us their backyard in exchange for some shares of vegetables. So, you know, we went over there and it was, the first day was pretty daunting. We were going to take a soil sample and send it up to get tested and see if we could plant right in the yard.
No, but you didn't want to know what was in there.
Oh, really, man. No. Crack vials full of crack.
Oh, wow.
First thing I raked up, I think,
full
was
of crack. So full, you could have sold it. Oh, okay.
On eBay.
Nice.
Yeah, vintage crack. So we were raking that up and we decided, you know, this is just totally untenable land. So we, you know, we pickaxed it down, graded it, and laid down tarps and started building beds. And it's just been incredible how willing people are to come out on their days off and spend time that, you know, that's what's at a premium these days, time. Everybody has so little of it, but folks have really, really shown up and come out. And, you know, we've had some carpenters and they were really great when we were building the boxes. And some folks up in Greenpoint who have a wood shop, they were really fantastic. And then we have some folks, I have a friend who works in a genetics lab, and he's a biologist, and he's just been incredibly helpful in terms of and helping us figure out, you know, what we should be feeding these plants, what needs more light, what needs less light. So we set up the nursery in the front of this radio station here and started popping the little guys in my roommate's collection of cottage cheese containers. That girl eats more cottage cheese. So we have like
God.
50. Yeah, exactly. Thank God for Dana and her cottage cheese addiction. So we had all these cottage cheese containers of little plants, little seedlings sprouting. Meanwhile, we went back there and built this garden. And
well, your volunteer mobilization is legendary. I mean, everyone talks about it, but tell us the steps. I mean, give us like a brief minute or two. What was the steps? Where did you come up with the idea and where are you today?
Well, you know, I mean, the guys at Roberta's have been really fantastic about getting everybody excited, and they said they wanted to build these gardens. So, you know, Chris is just spectacular about making it happen. And we started by buying lumber and putting these beds together. We laid down tarps because we didn't want anything getting through.
Yeah, and actually that was an interesting point you made about like the awful site you had as far as indigenous dirt. Aren't we basically in this area of Brooklyn sitting over one of the largest underground oil spills in the country?
I think it's the largest in U.S. history.
Yeah.
It's not just the oil spill. I mean, this neighborhood, it was home to a lot of factories, a lot of industry that dry cleaning.
Yeah.
And none of this was regulated. Not that long ago. So.
Yeah, I don't know. Is the Gowanus still water? I'm not even sure if that's...
I mean, it might be a super fun site.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, they're actually...
They're working on it, yeah.
They're worried about even making it, calling it that, because they don't want it to have, you know,
well, they don't want to lose...
Right.
Yeah,
right. That's another story, though.
Another story.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's been a little bit of a challenge, but you know, we put the tarps down, and we put a ton of drainage material in, and then we got our soil delivery. So we found this guy on Craigslist and Vito, and he shows up 3 hours late. And you know, it's the backyard site, so
no disrespect.
You know, I believe there was a pistol in place of an L on the side of his truck. I forget what the word was, but yeah. So we're wondering if a body was gonna like roll out of the back of this truck along with the soil.
It's got some extra dirt.
You know, and it was total BS. He told us that it was from an old
holes,
horse
apparently.
Farm. But, you know, I mean, it didn't smell like manure at all. And, you know, these guys weren't cooking it, so.
Are you worried about the effect that's going to have on the plants, or can survive?
What ended up happening is we underestimated to a degree the extent to which we'd built huge beds. And they're really tall. They're about 4 feet tall, so, or maybe 2.5 feet tall. So we needed far more soil than we realized. I think we got about 18 yards to start and ended up having to get a second delivery from Long Island Compost, which is much, much better soil than
first soil was your base, and then the good composted nutritious soil.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going to take a look at what nutrients we've got going in that soil and see if we can amend it with some compost, see what it needs, depending on what you have growing. So up here, you know, above the shipping container, we're going to have a lot of tomatoes, a lot of peppers, things that really just want to cook in the sun.
Yeah, peppers then, grow well up on this stuff.
Yeah.
We're happy about it because it's going to keep us cool in the summer.
Yeah, I know. It's like 10 degrees cooler here than it is upstairs. Well, we're going to take a brief break and then come back, and we want to hear about, is it called the Brooklyn Avant Gardeners?
Well, that's kind of been evidently somebody has already got that name. So the Avant Gardener Project is sort of a...
So the Bushwick Avant Gardeners.
Yeah, or the Bucket Brigade when we were firelining soil back in the gardens.
I was there that day, and it was quite a sight to behold. It was amazing. There was like 30 people there. Just
where were you when we got the second delivery? There were 9 of us. I'm still covered
somewhere
in bruises.
Else.
I was somewhere else. I was aching, probably my muscles aching. Well, we'll come back with Anastasia, and we'll have another guest, Brandon Hoy, who's a big partner in this whole Brooklyn Avant Gardening movement.
We're going down.
we're back at the Q Report. I'm here with my co-hosts, Mark Marabella.
Mark Marabella talking about fear.
And Ed Grant.
Yes, I love the fear.
Fear and loathing.
Fear and loathing. So we have another guest here, one of the owners and founders of Roberta's, Brandon Hoy. How's it going, Brandon?
It's going good. What is the fear?
The fear is just a general topic, and it was prompted from the fear that seems to be sweeping the pandemic of the fear of pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, we were seeing people like in Barnes & Noble, other places with... I saw a woman masks. In Barnes & Noble with a dust mask on. And it's just like, you know, it's not going to help you. I'm sorry. Wash your hands. That will do a lot more, you know.
But there's a hope to all this industrial farming, right, which is the kind of gardening movement, right, urban gardening. And Brandon, tell us about some of the things that you're growing here, like literally what kind of fruits and vegetables.
Literally. What on the roof right now, we have black creme tomatoes and red lightning tomatoes, yellow pear tomatoes, Roma tomatoes.
I'm definitely coming here. When can we have a tomato salad?
I'm definitely coming here.
in August when they're all ripe for my tomato salad.
Sorry, I didn't hear that question.
I'm sorry.
They're a few months out before we...
Yeah, when can we have a tomato salad?
Yeah, we have a few months out. We probably have 6-8 weeks before.
What's been the greatest challenge, I mean, to start a garden where one didn't exist before?
I mean, running a restaurant and running a farm at the same time is the biggest challenge. There's two worlds that I have to live in constantly, and it's very difficult for me to do both things. So that's the biggest challenge. But organizing and getting people on board to actually move this project forward has kind of become the hardest part of my job.
Well, also, you'd think just getting dirt above ground level, you know, just simply moving tons and
that's
tons
just
of
manpower.
Dirt. Still getting it done, man.
That's just manpower.
But Brandon, it seems like it's symbiotic, right? Your restaurant is going to benefit, and so will your farm, in the sense of you're going to...
Well, these guys tell us what we're going to do. So they say, we want these things. I mean, Carlo...
Your chefs.
For
those who don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Carlo, yeah.
And Anastasia, what is the hope for a garden like this and urban farming in general? I mean, this is certainly a model, but I mean, if you were to replicate it times 50 lots or 1,000 lots or 1,000,000 lots, what is the potential of urban farming?
Yeah, and I mean, I think this conversation is incredibly apropos to the discussion of fear, because that's what it's all about. It's an investment. So you invest the money. I mean, these guys took a huge chance when they spent the money on the lumber, when they spent the money on the soil, and it's about... You know, all right, are these guys who've never planted, you know, I'm back there like popping seeds, and I'm like, oh, I think I'm only supposed to put one seed in each of these. I just dumped like half a packet out. So I'm like picking up marigold seeds and moving them around, you know. But I think a lot of people out there are afraid to make that investment. But ultimately, you know, if you can get the return on that, if and it's been spectacularly easy to put things in soil and then see them grow. It's like, wow.
How do you measure the return, though? That's kind of the stress that lies on me, is how do you measure the return? What exactly are we getting from this? Is the movement bigger than the actual profit gain? It is. Yeah. I mean, what we're doing is we're giving back to the community and we're trying to like get in touch with where our food comes from. Mm-hmm. And that's the important part.
But I would imagine, and again, this is to your point of how do you measure it, but I would imagine, like me, just from my own perspective and my friends, that if people know that your vegetables are literally grown in your backyard, that's going to lend itself, certainly at the very least, a marketing tool to have people, whether or not it actually increases feet through the door or butts in the seat, so to speak, is another question. But still, it's like, I would imagine it would accentuate the food that's already fantastic here. Does it cut out of your vegetable bills or all, anything like that?
It will. It doesn't right now, but I mean, this is something that's going to take a lot of time and a lot of manicuring and a lot of attention. And as years go on, we'll be better at this, and we can grow better, more productive vegetables. Yes,
absolutely. It's a very burgeoning movement. I mean, Anastasia sent me some very interesting stat that 0.2% of the Earth's surface is classified as urban, and yet it's home to nearly half of its population. And consumes 75% of its resources. So, I mean, talk about easing the burden of the, you know, cities on farmland, which is dwindling.
And transporting food to it.
But the thing is high-density urban populations are far more efficient than suburbs and exurbs.
Right,
if
because
we were New York
such
City,
a concentration.
Just surrounded by farmland, it would be much better than what we're surrounded by
right
now.
But a lot of those cities that, you know, you saw them sort of collapse when industry moved out, I went to school in Poughkeepsie, and that's a great example.
Mm-hmm. Buffalo.
Well, me too.
As did Patrick, both Vassar alums, and it's spectacular to take a look at it and see that all it could be used for farmland, but there's no money there, and I think that there's a great opportunity to use a lot of these places as sort of waste processing centers, compost centers, maybe solar power conversion fields. Just use this land that's right now doing nothing for us because there's no money to build on it. Mm-hmm.
And there won't be for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, let's see some of that. Let's see some money there. Let's get some private public partnerships.
Yeah, and another thing about this, like just what's going on the rooftop above the studio, it's not just being driven by the market. It's actually being driven by a philosophical idea.
Which is what Brandon was saying a second ago.
Well, it's driven by my hands, literally driven by my hands. My hands and soil is a very addictive thing, so I'm constantly...
But we read, Patrick earlier in an earlier broadcast went on a tirade against a professor in Texas versus free-range pig farming and industrial pig farming. I found another thing where a woman outside of D.C. was complaining about all organic farming is elitist, nobody can afford it, mm-hmm. and oh, it's all bad. And
it's the opposite.
We're not just worried about market value. It's a philosophy.
You're right, Mark. It is the opposite, though. It's truly the opposite.
And once
people realize it, it becomes, common language for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you guys go to the Brooklyn conference this weekend? I mean, how was urban farming a big part of it?
Tell us what the conference was, Patrick.
The conference was a very important conference about, gathering people, making connections of the people that are going to be manning this revolution
organic
towards
food,
sustainability
specifically,
and organic food. So, I mean, was urban farming a big component towards what they were talking about?
I didn't make very many of the seminars, which was actually what I realized to be the greatest thing that was going on there. We walked through all the both floors of exhibits that they had, and it was, so-so. There wasn't much going on, but I think the people that were speaking there was really where you were going to get all your information from. So if you were prepared and you went there with notes and you knew what you wanted to get out of it, it was gold.
Well, this is, I know, the first of many times that you guys are going to be on, hopefully with your own shows, but certainly on the Q Report again. If you haven't been to Roberta's, please come. It's in 261 Moore Street.
You're missing out if you haven't.
How do you volunteer for your gardening group? Is there an email or a website?
BrooklynAvantGardeners@gmail.com. We'd love to have you.
BrooklynAvantGardeners@gmail.com.
The dishes are piling up in here because we're eating so much.
I know. The pizza is so good. And actually, people mistake this place for a pizza place, but it's actually an unbelievably good restaurant. My mom says it's her favorite place.
I haven't had anything bad here yet.
I know. Simple.
I'm assuming it will come, but every meal.
And congratulations.
I got a treat for you, Mark.
Congratulations, Brandon, on handing off brunch, something you started a few months ago.
Oh, it's fantastic.
First Sunday off.
It's a very unique brunch, too.
First Sunday off.
It's really stuff you get here you can't get anywhere else, and it's all organic. It's delicious.
Thank you. We are going to come back with one final segment on fear and plastic surgery. With our guest Molly Ward, but thanks so much, Anastasia.
And if
Brandon.
If anyone out there wants us to garden their space, BrooklynAvantGardeners@gmail.com. Give us a shout. We want some gardens.
Awesome. Excellent. Or stop by and write your name down at the Roberta's sign-up sheet at the front. All right.
Thanks. Get your hands dirty.
We'll be right back.
here we are for the final segment of the Q Report. I think this might have been the best Q Report ever.
It's gone way too fast. Would anybody want to listen to us longer than an hour? I don't know.
Well, I think that because we segmentize it on the website, you know, you don't have to.
That's true, actually.
That's the beauty.
Build your own show.
Someone said that God's greatest gift to man is to allow man to tolerate the sound of his own voice. And the second greatest gift is that you can find a girl who will also tolerate it. If you can get those, you're totally set.
Yeah.
Well, we have as our final guest, I'm a big fan. I actually went to Vassar. This is a Vassar thing. Anastasia went to Vassar, and now Molly Ward went to Vassar.
Hi.
Hey, Molly.
Hi.
What is it with Vassar, man? Vassar people just glom together. I knew some Vassar people a few years ago.
This is what happens when you insult Vassar. No one listens. No. But
is that an insult that they glom together? I don't know.
Yeah, like that we can't socialize and mingle with other universities.
It's just the male students who can't.
So exactly, they glom.
Unless we're too angry and then we just spite each other.
Yeah, there is jealousy. There's infighting. But now, Molly, on a show on fear, it struck me seeing your play last night at the Brick.
Yes, the Brick Theater.
Which is what, 450 Metropolitan Avenue? Or 475?
Is it 575? It's right at the Lorimer stop.
The Lorimer stop. It's right there. And tell us about this play. It's about plastic surgery, right? In medieval times?
Yeah, it's sort of it's a fable. It's framed as a bedtime story between a sort of roguish, underground, unlicensed plastic surgeon.
Medieval?
Well, no, we're getting there. Telling his 8-year-old daughter a bedtime story because she argues that, Daddy, maybe plastic surgeons like aren't really necessary in modern times. Mm-hmm. And so the father says, let me tell you the great history of nosemakers. So then we go back in time to medieval times. And then so the play is a quasi-historical...
Like Pinocchio, his father was a nose. He did nose jobs, right?
Oh, Pinocchio!
Yeah, that's a very good one. Yeah, we didn't think that
in the next rewrite of this play.
And now, so you played the 8-year-old girl, but then you also play the daughter of maybe the most famed nose repairman in England,
Wolfric.
Wolfric, who was a great actor, by the way.
Corey Sullivan is fantastic.
And so you were a.
So I was the 8-year-old girl listening to the bedtime story, and then as the story became so powerful, my imagination became alive, and then I stepped in as the medieval shepherdess.
Exactly.
the way that a little girl, you know, imagines she's the princess in the fairy tale.
So this, your father goes to an orphanage to pick up a young kid. I won't reveal too much about the play.
Yeah, don't give it away.
And then, you know, it's the story of this young apprentice who, you know, travels Europe and...
Learning the ancient quasi-fictional history of medieval appendage repair.
Yes.
You know, in medieval times, people would get diseases like syphilis, things like that. Their noses would fall off, and so...
But once your nose fell off with syphilis, your brain was half gone.
Although not... Well,
but, you know, amazing. There was a lot more axes used.
Let's not judge.
You know, wolves don't running judge. Around the woods, you know, just biting.
That's interesting.
And,
you know.
And what was his big dilemma? I mean, this apprentice and this fear, there's a kind of fear around plastic surgery.
Fear factory.
I mean, do you do things to fix things, or do you do things just for pure, you know, beauty?
For beautification or for noble purposes, I guess, is that.
It's interesting.
Is beautification a noble purpose, maybe?
Well, is it?
I don't know. I mean, scientifically speaking, you know, plastic surgeons started from, as she's pointing out, I think in the play, reconstructive. So it'd be people who are burn victims or damaged in some horrible accident.
Damage in the Crusades.
And of course, in America, we've gotten very good at it because, you know, people are into beauty. And also there's a lot of car accidents every year. You know, it hasn't really gone down despite seatbelts.
Well, a lot of plastic surgeons might say they help the kids with the cleft palates and stuff.
All that is true.
That's true.
All that is true, but it's gone on into obviously elective surgery versus somebody trying to get along without a nose, which is or jaws or that those type of things, which are huge.
But we can bring it back to, is beautification wrong? Really?
I don't think
so. Is body modification and beautification wrong?
Yes.
You think yes?
You think yes?
No,
You're being very declarative with
it. I am. I think
piercing and tattoos.
Piercing. Well, you know, I'm talking about physical. That's
no.
Those are sort of accoutrements.
That's probably a borderline thing in the sense of I wouldn't call that alteration of. I guess it is technically. You know, it's a permanent. It's a permanent.
Holes in the ears, the nose, the tongue.
You know,
okay,
I mean,
but that's different than changing actually the shape of your face.
I'm okay with it.
Can't we draw that line?
If I was like, 50, 60, I mean, I think maybe it's more for women, you know? Like, they don't feel as beautiful. They're not as self-conscious. What the hell?
People make women feel like you have to look young to be beautiful.
Yeah.
So older women feel like if they look young, they'll be prettier.
It's going to start happening to the boys, too. Though.
Like, you getting beautiful tattoos on your arm is a different thing.
Those are beautiful, by the way.
Is a different thing than a 16-year-old girl wanting a nose job. That's,
well, it was an 8-year-old girl in Molly's play.
My character. I went at a little tummy tuck. Daddy said I could wait until I was 11.
He was you have to wait until you're 11.
In medieval times, I don't think the little girls had to worry about obesity.
They played on that. They were like, how can anyone live up to these images and eat so much food that they can be that fat?
Right, exactly.
Because it was all reverse.
Poor people don't have money for food, so poor people don't get to be pretty.
Yeah, and I love that play. It was a really, really, really funny, funny, funny play, and a million little double entendres of, you know, playing on things.
That's a great script by Rachel Schuchert and Nick Jones.
If you all know about the Miss California or whatever this woman's name or whatever state she's from, super thin woman, but got a boob job. The pageant.
She was a 4-H member.
How does that work? I didn't understand that, actually.
And it's just like she's skinny. I mean, like underfed skinny, but yet, boink, you know, it's just like it's not real.
Stop right there.
Well, I mean, she was a past 4-H member, so she can do no wrong.
Really? Did she win? Did she have a competing? What did she have?
No, yeah. She lost because she said she didn't agree with...
No, I mean
with,
in the 4-H. Did she have a competing...
Oh, yeah,
competing?
She didn't agree with, like,
gay marriage.
Oh,
and she
Lord.
Feels that's why she lost. I think she looks like a freak.
Trump should have come out against that. He didn't. And I thought that was weird. I thought he should have been like, we don't need to be getting into that. He's like, that's her opinion. She should say what she wants to say.
But yeah, well, you know, he's the front man of his reality show, so...
Yeah.
Your play...
Yes, how do we get tickets
back
for your
play?
It's a grassroots fun play, and nice theater.
Yeah,
how
it's
do
a lovely
we get
space,
tickets?
The Brick Theater. You can go to Ovation Tickets online or www.thebricktheater.com, probably.
And how much are tickets? Are
tickets
just like
$18.
That's
yeah.
nothing.
Oh,
that's
it's something. A hot deal in Williamsburg.
It sounds like a really rich topic, as we've digressed many times off of it already.
And yeah, there are limitless digressions from this play.
It's great. It's fantastic.
What's Wolfric's name again, that actor?
Wolfric. Corey Sullivan.
I thought he was
Doyle.
Very talented.
Yeah.
Awesome, Molly.
Great
well,
cast.
Molly, I'll be back again.
Thank you.
Not just for fear. Themes,
I'm only coming back to talk
ones.
About fear.
This is great. I think we've had almost all the arts represented. Actress and artist.
Painting.
Painter,
I'm in food. You're a documentary.
Yeah.
You said, Ed, you don't do painting
visual?
Anymore. What do
no,
you
call my, it? You my education media. Was in painting, but I do photography now.
Just photography. Okay.
Just photography.
It looks like painting, though, when you superimpose
when
it. On
when I do the transfers, yes. And it's probably informed by painting, but I don't paint.
I have a piece of yours hanging in my apartment.
I know. I'm very grateful for
Ghost Bridge.
Yep.
It's beautiful.
I have two friends, and both of them have seen it, so I hope that launches
sweet.
Your...
Sweet. Oh, yeah, man, I'm on my way.
Awesome. We had Chris Sherman on. We had...
Paul Vogler.
Dave Selig from University of Pennsylvania, the Brain Man.
And next week's Q Report will be a theme that we will determine Saturday afternoon.
moments before we're off.
We're very
here.
Topical. Very topical.
Awesome. Well, this show is taking off. And another great week.
Excellent.
Thanks,
later, guys.
Bye.